I knew wanted to stay home? Most of us will grapple with this, and the vast majority of those who do won't pursue anything that might come at the expense of anyone else's happiness. You want to join a gym, but that would require your husband to watch the baby so you can go work out, and he doesn't like to watch the baby? Oh, shoot. Well, I guess you can't go. Or you want to move to a new city, but your family is super close and your mom will freak out if you're not nearby? Okay, I guess you'll just live forever right where you are. Or you want to use your retirement traveling the world like you always dreamed of, but your daughter was counting on having you nearby to help her with the kids? All right, you better let that vision for your life go. After all, their happiness matters more than yours does, right? They matter more than you do. The only way to be a good mother, daughter, sister, friend, or whatever is to show up for the other parties exactly how they want you to, when they want you to. Right? Ladies, you get one chance at this. Literally, only one chance at this life. And you have no idea when your chance might be over. You cannot waste it living only for everyone else. I don't mean that you should be wholly selfish. I don't mean that you should assume life is only about you and what makes you happy. Part of being in a family or a relationship or a community means showing up for others. The problem is that most women I know don't struggle to show up for others. They struggle to show up for themselves. I was talking with my dad the other day about the idea for this book. I told him that I wanted to write about pursuing and achieving goals. I told him how many women send me notes asking me how to find the courage to do that. He told me to tell you to be selfish. You know what they told me on the first day of class for my PhD? My dad always, always starts any story with a question, knowing full well his audience doesn't know the answer. I used to hate it as a child because I assumed he just liked to prove his superior intellect. As an adult, though, I can look back and see that he was teaching us, from a very early age, to work through a problem before waiting for someone to tell us the answer. Now, of course, I do the exact same thing to my kids and cringe to imagine what my 8-year-old self would think of it. In any event, I didn't have an answer for him that day. No, Daddy, what did they tell you? They told us to be selfish. They told us that getting a PhD later in life was something you did for yourself and nobody else. They told us that it wouldn't be long before our spouse or our kids or our boss got frustrated by our classes or our homework or how long it takes to write a thesis. They told us if we weren't selfish with this one thing, our dream of having a doctorate, we'd let someone else talk us out of it. I'm going to assume that you spend a good deal of your life thinking about others and caring about others and being a great family member and employee and friend. But I'm going to tell you, at least as far as your goal is concerned, that you're allowed to focus on it even if it means that you'll miss some time with the people you care about. I'm also going to encourage you to ask yourself, just like in the previous chapter, if something is true or if something is opinion. There are two extremely well-known opinions that play deeply into the narrative about what you can and can't be simultaneously. The first is work-life balance. The idea that work and life can ever be perfectly in balance is an opinion. It's the million-dollar question for every working mom. Right, ladies? How do you balance your job and your family? It's a valid question and worth discussing if for no other reason than that it's reassuring to hear other working moms struggle with this too. My thoughts on this topic are really quite strong, and I don't mind telling you exactly what I've said on numerous business panels over the last decade. Work-life balance is a myth. More than that, it's a hurtful myth. because I don't think anyone actually achieves it, and yet we feel positive that other women somehow have. Someone, somewhere, mentioned it as a possibility. Their opinion, mind you. And the media seemed to latch on. So when we feel off balance or are struggling to keep all our balls in the air, we assume it's just because we haven't figured out work-life balance. It becomes one more thing we're failing at as moms, beyond forgetting it was weird and wacky her day at school and buying the wrong kind of yogurt. Ugh, I detest anything that makes women feel wrong or less than, so allow me to debunk this ridiculous idea. Work-life balance. Its description implies that those two things live in harmony, perfectly divided up on the scale of your life. My work and home life have never, ever been balanced evenly on any level. Even when I was a 17-year-old sandwich maker at the substation in my hometown, even then there were days when a big project at school meant that I couldn't work as many hours, or accepting a lucrative Saturday shift, ripe with tip money, meant that I couldn't hang out with my friends. Work and personal life will always battle each other for supremacy because both require your full attention to be successful. It's not bad or wrong, it's just how life works. Sometimes my boys have school activities or doctor's appointments, and I have to leave work to be present for those. Likewise, right now as I sit holed up at the only desk in our house, in my big boy's room, my entire family is having a grand time downstairs by the pool. I can hear them down there laughing and singing along to pop music. They're drinking LaCroix and living their best lives, and I'm up here writing this book. Pursuing my dream of being an author who encourages other women means that sometimes I will have to miss out on pool time in order to make it happen. The scale is never balanced. It constantly shifts back and forth based on what needs my attention right this second. I think that's real for most of us, no matter what stage of life we're in, and the only way we're going to get past this mythology that some people have it all figured out is to start being honest about what our lives and priorities really look like. Here, I'll go first. Myself. In my early days as a mom and entrepreneur, I wasn't a priority at all. I would run myself ragged, taking care of everyone else and never once worrying about how it all might affect me. This was a disaster. I got really sick at least once a year. I was always stressed out. I was always struggling with my weight. It was a mess. Then, someone pointed out that I couldn't take care of anyone properly if I didn't first take care of myself. My health and well-being are now my biggest priority. I get 8 hours of sleep every night. Yes, 8, not 6 or even 7. 8 full hours. I eat well. I drink water by the bucket load. I haven't let Diet Coke touch my lips in over 4 years. Yes, I'm still addicted to coffee, but we can't win them all. I took up running and get in at least 12 miles a week. I carve out several hours a week for prayer, church, and volunteer work because my faith is extremely important to me. I don't think the goal is ever to be balanced, ladies. I think the goal is to be centered. Centered means that you feel grounded and at peace with yourself. Centered means that you can't be knocked off balance regardless of how chaotic things become. If I prioritize myself and make sure I'm centered, then everything else runs smoothly, even when it's running at 100 miles an hour. My marriage. I'm sure many parents would naturally list their children as their first priority, but my marriage will always be the most important relationship in my life. Dave and I have a weekly date night, and we take an extravagant annual vacation together, wait for it, without our children. When we're at home, we're playing interference with three little boys and our queen bee, Noah Elizabeth. So it's essential that we always get to hang out with each other regularly and act like real live adults. Because we're both so supportive of each other's careers, it can be really easy to start neglecting our relationship, which has happened numerous times over the years. So, rather than risk our marriage slipping into an unhealthy place, we've agreed to make each other a priority. We don't want to have a good marriage or even a great one. We want to have an exceptional marriage. And exceptional requires intentionality. My kids. I have 4 children, Jackson, Sawyer, Ford, and Noah. So even when I'm not at work, I'm always on the go. There's morning routine and school drop-off and dinner, baths, books, and bedtime. Then the weekends, when we run from sports events to birthday parties and back again. That is a picture of what life looks like today with the kids. But let me back up and tell you about the first 2 years of running my company. I worked like a maniac. I was often in the office by 8 in the morning, which means I was never able to do school drop-off. I got snarky notes from moms at school about missing field trips and bake sales, and I cried myself to sleep about them more nights than I can count. Nobody ever sent snarky notes to my husband for having to work during a field trip, but that's a diatribe for another time. Most evenings, I got home around 7, which means I missed dinner. It was a really chaotic season, but that kind of workload is also part of being an entrepreneur and running a startup. Some people will argue that I lost valuable time with my kids, and I won't disagree. But those 3 little boys also watched their mom build a company from the ground up. They watched me grow that company to something so big that their daddy came to work there too. They've seen firsthand the power of hard work and dedication, and I'm proud of the example I've set for them. That, for me, in that season, was another way of prioritizing my kids, just with a longer-term vision in mind. My work. I won't pretend that there weren't times when work didn't take up most of my attention. I also won't pretend that those weren't the times that were hardest on my marriage, my health, and my ability to be the kind of mom I want to be. Now that I'm more established in my career, I'm able to get my work done during office hours. Also, being 5 years into this business means I have the help of an incredible staff, so it doesn't all fall on my shoulders. My work is a priority for sure, but that looks different in my current season than it had to look in past ones. Remember, figuring out how to juggle all the parts of your life in a healthy way is a scale that slides back and forth. Some seasons of your life will require more attention in one area than another, and that's okay. Someone once said it was possible to be in balance, but that's only their opinion. You get to decide whether or not it's true. The other opinion that affects our narratives about what we can and can't be at the same time dives into an area of life that I know won't apply to every woman listening to this, but it will apply to a vast majority, and the ones who suffer from it are drowning in it. I want to talk about it. I want us all to be aware that it's happening so we can, as a community, take power away from this insidious thing. Mommy guilt. You guys, mommy guilt is bullshit. There, I said it. I don't know if my editor will even let me keep that in here, but if we're going to hold on to one cuss word in this book, Jessica, let it be that line right there. Mommy guilt, in case you haven't ever experienced it personally, is this gross, horrendous, cancerous thing that lodges itself in your heart and creeps its way to your head where it festers forever unless you actively choose to kill it. Mommy guilt likes to remind you on the regular of all the ways you're failing your children. Some women struggle with guilt on topics like going to work. Others struggle under the weight of guilt associated with everything from wanting time for themselves to not feeding their kids the right kind of blueberries. And I guess, if that was the only thing you had to worry about, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But being a mom means there are 967 things to worry about on any given day. So not only are you responsible for someone else's clothes and shelter and dental hygiene, But you're also going to go ahead and beat yourself up for those 967 choices you're making as you're making them and think that this will empower you to be better next time? No way. This is only going to confuse and overwhelm you and zap you of whatever confidence you had in yourself as a mom, which, let's be honest, is tenuous on the best of days. I can already hear the critiques on this one. Well, you told us to be self-aware. You told us we should be honest about the areas where we can improve. You're right. The problem is that mommy guilt isn't about self-awareness. Mommy guilt is about self-destruction. Part of growth in any area of life is a willingness to make changes to improve. But mommy guilt isn't really about improving, and more often than not, it's debilitating. And yet, we go back to it again and again. Hear me when I say this. It doesn't serve you in any way. It doesn't serve your children either. I said something like this recently on a live stream, and a commenter said something like, "No, guilt is so important. Feeling guilty is how we know we're doing something wrong. Guilt is God's way of telling us we're making bad choices." Holy crap. No, seriously, that's a load of crap wrapped up and pretending to be holy. I don't care what religion you were raised in, you weren't taught guilt and shame by your creator. You were taught guilt and shame by people. That means whatever your people thought was shameful is what you learned to be ashamed of. Whatever your family or the influential people in your life thought was something to feel guilty about is what you have guilt about now. Allow me to give you a way too personal example of this. I grew up in the 80s as a Pentecostal preacher's daughter. Suffice it to say, I was not taught to view my sexuality as something good. In fact, I wasn't taught to view my sexuality at all for any reason at any time. That's something I was supposed to save for marriage. Nobody told me exactly what I was saving or what I should do with it once I did get married. It's not any great surprise or any great originality to say that I was super uncomfortable getting comfortable with sex. My entire life, nobody ever spoke to me about sex except as this thing that was shameful to give away before a certain time. The problem is that even after that time came, I couldn't let go of the shame I'd learned to associate with it. It took me years of work to get past this, and I'm happy to report that now my sex life with my husband is fantastic, thank you very much. But the shame I felt having sex with my husband in the beginning was very real. And I don't believe for one second that this guilt I was feeling was God telling me sex with my husband was wrong. Guilt and shame are not from God. So please don't allow yourself to assume that your mommy guilt is something divine. Mommy guilt only works to make you question everything you have done, are doing, or might consider doing in the future. Everywhere you look, articles and books and shows suggest this or recommend that. The moms at school only like this brand or that style, and heaven forbid you parent differently than your sister-in-law or how your husband was raised. Stop the madness. Number one, dang it, you are doing your freaking best. The fact that you're experiencing any guilt right now tells me that you care about your children and you're trying. You're not always going to be the exact kind of mom you wish you were, even when you're trying your hardest. Today, I was trying to put sunscreen on Noah's chubby cheeks, and she fell backward and bonked the back of her head on the wood floor. Then she cried like the world was ending. You guys, I was trying to put SPF 80 plus sunscreen on her to keep her safe, and I accidentally made her trip over her swim diaper. I was trying my best, and I still somehow managed to suck at it. That's life. That is parenting. When did we pass some law that we're supposed to do this flawlessly? When I was little, We rolled around without seatbelts in the back of a station wagon. Nobody cared about car seats or automobile safety. One of my friend's moms laughs and laughs if you try to talk to her about safe pregnancy practices. "Darling," she'll say as she waves her hand in your general direction, "it was the 60s. I had a martini every single day during all three of my pregnancies." I mean, what kind of screwed up madman situation was going on back then? We're all doing our best, sis, and beating yourself up when you're trying so hard isn't going to help you do it better next time. You'll be a better mama next month than you were this month. And 5 years from now, you'll be better still. 2 decades from now, you'll horrify some new mother when you tell her the barbaric things you did when your kids were still small. In the meantime, hopefully you'll work to improve in all areas of your life, including parenting. But I promise you, it doesn't serve you in any way to castigate yourself now. It's possible to pursue something for yourself while simultaneously showing up well for the people you love. It's possible to be a great mother and a great entrepreneur. It's possible to be an awesome wife and still want to get together regularly with your girlfriends. It's possible to be this and that. It's possible to decide that you're going to be centered in who you are and what matters most to you, and let other people's opinions fall away. Don't buy into the hype or the pressure or the guilt that you've got to be one or the other. Maybe that's true for other people. Maybe that's their opinion. But only you get to decide what's true for you. Excuse 6. I'm terrified of failure. 850,000 people watched me fail. Let's go ahead and start right there, because I know for many of you, the idea of falling short in front of even a small group of witnesses is terrifying. 850,000. They watched me set a goal, publicly talk about how much I wanted it, and then they saw the aftermath when it didn't happen. It went down like this. Like most red-blooded American authors, I have long dreamed of writing a New York Times bestseller. For those of you who aren't familiar with this mythical distinction, making it onto this list is basically the unicorn of the publishing world. I think at one time it was all dependent on book sales, but somewhere along the way it became more nebulous. It seems nobody, save the people who work there, can tell you exactly how you get on it. It has to do with sales and press and buzz and, I assume, some form of ritual sacrifice. My last book, Girl Wash Your Face, was my 6th one to go out into the world, and I knew it would have the best chance of making it onto the list. It's worth saying real quick that I fully understand that a random list doesn't determine my books or my own worth. In fact, to some people, it might be a ridiculous target to aim for. After all, it's about the work. It's about the women who loved it. It's about the gift of having your writing in book form in the first place. But we all have dreams we hold close to our hearts. We all have hopes that really only make sense to us. Becoming a New York Times bestselling author was mine. It had been my birthday candle wish for the last 15 years. It's what ran through my head when I wished upon a star or blew dandelion seeds into the wind. If forced to give you a rationale behind it, I suppose it's because it would feel validating. My entrance into the publishing world wasn't exactly smooth. And even though my fan base has grown with every subsequent release, I guess there's a part of me that would love acknowledgement. Like, hey, the publishing community is sorry about the complex it gave you when it told you no one would ever buy your book. JK, you're actually a decent writer. So anyway, I dreamed about it for years, but never admitted it to anyone because I didn't want anyone to know lest they judge me for not making it. But this time around, I decided to bring everyone in on the dream. I decided to tell my online audience, at the time, 850,000 women all over the world, about this lifelong hope of mine. I figured if it did happen, then they would share in the victory. After all, they're the ones who support me. And if it didn't happen, well, it would certainly be a lesson for us all. The thing is, as a public figure, you're never supposed to call your shot. If you just keep your hopes and dreams locked up inside your mind or within a small trusted circle, then no one will be let down by your failures because they didn't know what the goal was in the first place. This tactic also means that the public can be surprised and delighted by any success you have. They never know what you're working on, so any achievement feels like a happy little coincidence, fate smiling down on you again. The issue for me with this way of thinking is that it feels disingenuous. It feels like faking. Here I am telling you to be courageous and brave and to do big things and dare to reach for something mighty. Here I am telling you that failure doesn't matter and other people's opinions are none of your business. But then simultaneously, I'm just going to keep all of my big hopes close to the vest? That feels hypocritical. I strive to tell you guys about everything I'm going through or have gone through, because I don't think it serves any of us to pretend. So, with Girl Wash Your Face, I did the thing an author is never supposed to do. I called my shot. 4 months before the release of the book, I told everyone, and by everyone, I mean you guys who follow me on social media, that I have always dreamed of being a New York Times best-selling author. This was my 6th book, and I'd had years of dreaming about this, and so I talked about it a lot. It became a rallying cry for women all over the world. Not only was it my dream, but many of you got fired up on my behalf. You dreamed my dream right along with me. Then came the fateful day. It was Valentine's Day, exactly a week after the book came out, and unfortunately for him, it was also my husband's birthday. That afternoon, I found out my wish hadn't come true. Girl Wash Your Face didn't make the New York Times bestseller list. I felt so sad, and honestly, I felt embarrassed. I felt like I'd ask my tribe to buy into something that then I couldn't deliver. It was crushing. I cried like a baby. And I spent a few days in the dumps. But I came to a conclusion pretty quickly. And even with all the sadness and embarrassment, I wouldn't take my goal back. I go on social media every single day and tell other women to follow their dreams. I wake up and do live streams and tell you that your goals are important and worth chasing. I write over and over again that failure is a part of life. Failure means that you're living. Failure means that you're trying. So what kind of friend would I be if I didn't practice that in my own life? I had called my shot, voiced my big, crazy, audacious dream. I had told 850,000 people I was aiming for something, and they had all watched me fail. But here's the truth. If you aim at what you can hit, you'll likely get there every time. Never any higher, never any bigger, never any better. But if you aim far above your own head, even when you fail, you'll fly so much higher than you can imagine. I would rather fly. I would rather dream. I would rather fall on my face over and over again. I will continue to tell you what I'm aiming at, because I hope that if you watch me fall publicly and stand back up again and again and keep going, then you'll think, what if, for yourself? What if you sign up for a marathon? What if you go back to school? What if you start that bakery? What if you quit your job? What if you take up hip-hop dancing? What if you go into ministry? What if you write a book? What if you start a podcast? You have dreams. I know you do. And I also know that many of you hold back because you're afraid that others will see you stumble. Let them watch. Let them see what grit looks like. Let them see the mistake. Let them watch the missteps. Let them see you dust yourself off again and again and again and keep going. Do you know how many times I have failed as I've built my business and pursued my dreams over the last 14 years? I'm sure most of you won't remember, but I will never forget each and every lesson I learned along the way. What does it take to get back up when you've been knocked down? As an entrepreneur, I've been knocked down or tripped up by my own fumbling again and again. When I was younger, I imagined that at some point I'd gain enough experience to avoid failure altogether. Bless my tiny business baby heart. This level of success only makes my failures much more public and much larger in scale. Remember that time I launched the chic site in Italy? Remember that time an employee stole money from me and I had no idea? Remember when I decided to be a florist as well as a wedding planner? Remember when I added on luxury gift baskets too? Nobody wanted the flowers or the gift baskets, in case you're wondering. My list of failures is miles long. I'm totally aware of how much time and money they cost me along the way. But here's the deal. Every single one of those mistakes has taught me something to ensure they don't happen again. Knowing something great can be mined from the ashes means I don't beat myself up when I don't get it right. It means I stand back up quicker, more determined than ever. A mistake that you learn from is how you build best practices. It's only truly a failure when you're so afraid to look at it that you can't move forward. If you can't move forward, you will never, ever make it across the finish line. 10 weeks after the book came out, the impossible happened. Or maybe not impossible, but unbelievable to me. Girl, Wash Your Face became a New York Times bestseller. I can tell you that when the publisher called to let me know, I literally fell to my knees. I was so stunned. I called Dave at work. I made his assistant pull him out of a meeting. "I made the list," I whispered when he called me back. His screams and cheers broke whatever dam I had up when I found out. I cried like a baby. That night, we went home and had a drink we'd been planning for a decade. 10 years earlier, someone had given us a very expensive bottle of Dom Perignon. The bottle was so fancy, I felt like we should reserve it for something special. At the time, I thought of the biggest, loftiest dream I could imagine, and I labeled that bottle with my goal. New York Times bestseller, scrawled across a piece of tape and stuck to the neck. For 10 years, it sat in our fridge. It moved from our first townhouse to the little fixer-upper to the home I wrote all of my books in. The bottle was covered in dust and had been shoved to the back of cabinets, spending half a decade in the crisper of our beer fridge. And here's the crazy thing. I labeled that bottle back before I'd ever written a single page of a book. I labeled that bottle half a decade before my first book was published. I had dreamed of being a bestseller since I was 11 years old. I had imagined what it would be like to celebrate by opening that bottle for a decade. That night, after 10 years of waiting, we drank that champagne, and it was so much sweeter because of all the years from there to here. It was so much better because I had failed again and again on the quest for this goal. And if I hadn't been willing to put myself out there, if I hadn't been willing to let the public see me fail in 100 different ways over the years leading up to this moment, I would never have achieved any of it. I am so grateful I was a failure. I'm so grateful it's taken me 14 years of mistakes to get to this place in my career. I'm so grateful that each book I've written has done a little bit better than the last, but not one of them has been an overnight success. My writing career, much like my entrepreneurial career, is a snowball rolling downhill. It's only recently that the mass has picked up enough speed to make the ground shake. I'm grateful for the small spaces I've inhabited. They taught me how to grow. I'm grateful for every misstep along the way. They taught me how to run. I'm grateful for every moment of insecurity. They propelled me to gain a lifetime of confidence earned through practice and study. Had any of it happened quickly or easily, I might have associated the wins with luck or innate skill. Battling through hardship to get here means I have absolute certainty in this truth. I can achieve anything if I'm willing to work for it. Not because I'm especially gifted, but because I'm especially dedicated to improving along the way. Sis, don't be afraid of failure. Be afraid of never achieving anything at all, because you were too afraid of what others might think of you for trying. Excuse 7. It's been done before. It's one of those things we all do, right? We look at her life or her work or her Instagram, and we let her success talk us out of chasing anything for ourselves. We stop ourselves from writing that book, opening that business, building that app, starting that nonprofit, because someone else has already done it. It's been done before. Well, of course it has. But sister, everything has been done before. Kissing, dating, getting married, winged eyeliner, white jeans, bangs. Honestly, everything that sounds interesting or cool or like something you might want to try, it's already been done. So why is it that we don't let that deter us in any other scenario except pursuing something big? Because we need an excuse. Please note, I didn't call this section of the book legitimate obstacles to get around. I called it excuses to let go of. The fact that someone has already done the thing you're dreaming of shouldn't be a deterrent. It should be a sign that you're on to something. Dang, look at Susie already making rainbow doilies on Etsy. That just proves that it's fulfilling and fun to make and sell crafts online. What's that? Your cousin Emily is already killing it in that direct sales jewelry company? Oh, I guess that means it really is an incredible place to build community and a side income. But instead of seeing other people's success or creativity as a good thing, as a sign that pursuing something more for your life has value, you decide that it's a competition and you'd rather not try at all in case you're not as good as she is. Sure, this is partly about feeling like you're not enough, but it's also about the unhealthy game of comparison. One of the messages I get all the time from women is, I loved your book and I'd love to be an author, but I can never write like you do. Or, I've always wanted to do public speaking, but I'm not as good as you are. Girls, stop comparing your beginning with my middle. Or anyone else's for that matter. What you are listening to right now is my 8th book. And I'm not saying it's Pulitzer material, but it's light years away from my first in terms of skill. Have you ever looked at my Instagram feed and thought it was pretty? Scroll back a couple of years, just for funsies, and see what it looked like when I was just figuring out my personal style or how to not look like a robot in photos. Go look at the blog too. Some of those original posts are doozies. You think I'm a good public speaker? Please go peep on my old YouTube videos where I'm speaking at MOPS groups and at the local senior citizens home, I kid you not, I intentionally keep the older content in my feeds and on my website because if you ever fall down an internet rabbit hole some night and find some of my original work, I want you to see the progress. I did not wake up like this. And that person you're comparing yourself to, neither did they. You stop yourself from trying because you think it's already been done. Well, of course it has, but it hasn't been done by you. There's a great Chinese proverb that says, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now. You can keep talking yourself out of the things you're hoping for, or you can decide that your dream is more powerful than your excuse. This isn't a question of whether you can do something well, because nearly anything can be learned. This is a question of whether you're humble enough to suck for as long as it takes you to become better. The ability to write well, or speak well, or do photography, or dance, or any old thing at all, those are learned and improved over time. But you're never going to get to the place where you become good or better or best if you won't even put your shoes on the starting blocks. We don't know whether you can speak like me, or write like Brené Brown, or take pictures like Jenna Kutcher. Sister, we can't determine when you'll cross the finish line because you won't even let yourself show up for the race. You are talking yourself out of something you haven't even attempted because you think you can't measure up to how someone else has done it. But this particular excuse is not about your skill. This excuse is about your fear. There are all sorts of different ways this type of fear manifests. So please feel free to identify with the one that describes you best and allow me to drop some truth bombs up in here. You're afraid that you'll suck because you've never done it before. Let me relieve you of this fear right now. You are going to suck. All beginners do. Because if you were secretly a prodigy at pursuing the dreams of your heart, some long-suffering yet dedicated teacher would have seen it in you long ago. We all saw Dangerous Minds. If Michelle Pfeiffer didn't see potential in you by now, you're not going to be perfect right out of the gate. Huzzah! There's zero pressure to be perfect now, so you can just have fun and get better. Your potential for improvement is exponential. You're afraid that you'll suck because you fail at everything, so why should this be any different? God's almighty nightgown. Is this really how you speak to yourself? Like, really? Number one, knock it off. You are beautiful and worthy of good things, and if you don't believe that, nobody will. Number two, go get my last book and read about the lies that are hurting you. This kind of belief is crushing and untrue. You have to begin with the way you speak to yourself and the things you believe you deserve before you attempt a new goal. First, learn to love yourself well and give yourself credit. Then, reach for more. You're afraid that you suck, and at least if you never try, no one, especially you, will be able to confirm that. Spoiler alert! This kind of thought doesn't come from an underachiever who's not good at anything. This kind of thought comes from a perfectionist. And truthfully, it's lame. There is so much incredible potential inside of you, but you're going to squander it because trying may or may not confirm that you're not as good as you thought you were. Stop being so hard on yourself. It's like that time on Saved by the Bell when Jessie succumbed to the pressures of schoolwork and being in her band Hot Sunday. Spanna was a perfectionist, but rather than admit that it was too much to keep up with it all or concede failure, she got addicted to drugs and had that now infamous breakdown to a Pointer Sisters song. Don't be Jessie Spanna. if you try for your goal, you probably will suck for a minute. Remember the part about sucking as a beginner? But you won't stay there for long. You'll work to get better, and you won't even need caffeine pills to do it. Look, here's the irony about this particular excuse. Even if you push yourself to confront it, you will keep encountering it for the rest of your life. When we're early on the path to personal growth or on the way to achieving a goal, we often have unrealistic expectations of what will happen once we get there. Like, if you just have the courage to do this one thing, then it will make you invincible to insecurity and indecision for the rest of your life. The reality is that every new mountain you attempt to scale will likely have been traversed by someone before you. Every new mountain. That means that once you get over this big goal in front of you, once you get to the summit, I'm really going all in on this analogy, guys, you'll see another mountain range in the distance. In fact, you'll realize that your mountain was actually just the foothill of something bigger and better. Personal goals are infinite and addictive. Once you achieve one, it makes you start to wonder what else you might be capable of. The answer? Anything you set your mind to. But first, you've got to get over this battle with comparison. Because friend, if you can't get over your fear of not doing it as well as they do, you'll never have the opportunity to be a trailblazer for someone else. As I work through edits on this book, I'm in the process of creating something that many, many people have done before me. I also have exactly zero qualifications to take on something this massive. About a month from now, a documentary that we made about my women's conference will be in movie theaters throughout North America. I mean, who in the actual heck do I think I am? Well, I'll tell you who I am not. I'm not a filmmaker or a movie industry insider, and when we started on this project, I had no idea how we would pull it off. It's the biggest thing we've ever attempted to do, and it will live in a space, in theater events and later streaming services, that are insanely oversaturated. Not only that, but there are people who are experts in this field, and sometimes even they fail at it. So what in the world makes me think we have a shot? Well, frankly, the project being successful wasn't what made me want to do it. In fact, I believe if I had focused on whether or not it would make money, I would have started to obsess over all the ways I was ill-qualified to take it on. Actually, what motivated me to try and work on something so outside my wheelhouse was, well, you. As we were planning our conference last year, I received thousands of emails and direct messages from women saying how badly they wanted to attend RISE and how much it would mean for their hearts to have the opportunity to be in our audience. The problem wasn't their desire to attend. The problem was their finances. It's expensive to attend a conference because of travel and hotels and the price of tickets required to cover the cost of renting out a space so large. Many women didn't have it in their budgets, and I took that to heart. For nearly a decade, I've been creating content and giving it away for free. And the idea that you might not be able to access something I believe in so passionately really hurt my heart. I spent months trying to figure out a way to bring the conference and the power of reaching for personal growth to women at a price they could afford. Then one day, on a random conference call, I heard about event cinema, which is a fancy term for putting a live event, like the ballet or a Justin Bieber concert, into movie theaters on a limited run. Dang it, I thought. If the Biebs can do this, I'm pretty sure I can do this. I asked myself a what-if question. What if we made a movie about RISE Weekend? What if I could find someone to partner with us to help get it into theaters? What if I could give the tribe the chance to create a girls' night out in their own community? I hope you can understand how insane this idea was. We didn't know how to make a movie or how to get it in theaters or literally hundreds of steps between there and here. We were the worst kind of dumb. We didn't know what we didn't know. But I didn't spend any time worrying about our lack of knowledge, and honestly, it didn't occur to me to care about who had done it better or how it might be received. I wasn't focused outside myself. I was focused on my why. My why was powerful. My why made me feel passionate enough to figure out my how. If you find yourself worried about the idea that someone else has already done it, you need to flip the script on whether that's a bad thing. If someone else has done it, you can research and model behavior and test out your own theories using their roadmap as some kind of guidance. You can combine their how with your why to create something epic. Excuse 8. What will they think? I started boxing. And just so we're all clear on this, I don't mean boxing at the 24-hour fitness. There's nothing wrong with boxing at your local gym. I just want to make clear the distinction between performing boxing-style moves for cardio at your usual workout spot and going to a real-life boxing gym that's dirty and smelly and blasts Metallica like it's required for the sport. I've only been to a few sessions so far, so for all I know, it is required for the sport. My point is, I'm getting real training from someone whose job it is to teach actual fighters how to throw a punch. The gym I'm going to for this training isn't pretty by any stretch of the imagination. The workout is grueling, and I often feel like I'm going to die or puke up my breakfast smoothie all over the ring. I don't fit in. Imagine a dirty room full of minotaurs and then me, all 5 feet 2 inches of me with my long, long extensions and my overly dramatic fake lashes. There I am, a 35-year-old mother of four, trying my darndest to slide away from punches lest my trainer knock me upside the head. I'm not exceptionally good at it, though truth be told, I've never seen any kind of boxing match, so I'm not totally sure what the end goal is supposed to be. So why do I do it? Why do I keep showing up to try something amongst people who are so much further along than I am? Why do I hang out in a room I don't fit in and keep attempting to learn something I'm not particularly skilled at, all while others watch and judge and draw their own conclusions? Because it makes me happy. I like throwing punches and working out to Jay-Z and flipping my hat around backward like a proper tomboy. I love boxing, and I love pushing myself to try something new. Here's the kicker. I don't care what anyone else thinks about that. But maybe you heard that and think, okay, big deal. You're comfortable at your boxing gym. I don't know how that's supposed to help me find the courage to start a business as a wedding photographer. Well, how about this? There are two types of people in the world. Non-judgmental people who aren't ever going to think badly of you for anything you do, regardless of the outcome, and judgmental people who are jerks. These jerks are probably working through their own issues and will pray for them. But at the end of the day, judgmental people are going to judge you no matter what. If they're going to judge you either way, then you may as well go for it. You may as well live your life. You may as well be true to who you are and what you value and let go of how it will be received. On Mondays, my kids have karate. On other days, there is baseball practice and piano practice and then karate practice again. We might have an audition for the school musical. We might have a dine-out night to support the PTA. We might have play dates or dentist appointments or simply need to make the trip, for the millionth time, to get everyone's hair cut. There are so many things to keep up with when you have 4 kids, and I don't always remember them no matter how hard I try. Yesterday, the school called to tell me that Ford is the very last child out of all the incoming kindergartners who still needs to turn in his paperwork. You guys, I didn't even know what paperwork she was talking about. Which brings me back to karate practice. Karate practice takes 2 hours, not including drive time, while first my youngest and then my big boys try to work their way up to the next belt color. Those 2 hours happen during a weekday afternoon when I should technically be working. But I want the boys to have the opportunity to do something cool, to not be held back by my schedule, which is something that happens more often than not. So, if I can make it work, I get off early and take them to practice. Then I sit down on the blue carpet amongst water bottles and flip-flops, and at some point, I open up my laptop and start working through emails or book edits that are due on Friday or the timeline for one of our live events. And inevitably, I start to get looks from the other parents. Now, maybe I'm being presumptuous. Maybe those looks are actually because they like my computer case, or they think my hair looks especially good in that top knot today. But if I had to guess, I'd say their looks are more about the fact that I'm working when I should be wholly devoted to watching my kids master their front kick. Some insecure part of me, the one that used to worry quite a bit about what other mothers thought of my parenting style, considers putting the computer away. But then, this is the trade-off. Or maybe, perk is a better word. So many working moms wish they can make it to practice even if it meant they were building a spreadsheet on Excel while their children karate chop the air to the Pokemon soundtrack. What a gift that I get to have that experience. So I don't put the laptop away. I remind myself that this is part of the deal, that these boys of mine will always know what hard work and dedication look like. I remind myself that someday when they're grown men, it will never occur to them that a woman can't start and build and run a successful company because that was always part of their reality. God willing, I'm the only mom my kids will ever know. And I honestly don't know any other way to make this all work for all of us without multitasking sometimes. So I refuse to teach them that you should pursue your dreams, but simultaneously be ashamed of them. If I don't want that for them as adults, I need to model that behavior for them now. I can't worry about what the other moms at practice think of me, and you can't worry about what the other moms or your in-laws or the PTA think of you. All you can do as a working mom is try your best. All you can do as a recent college grad is try your best. All you can do as a 50-something divorcee is try your best. All you can do at any stage and season of life is try your best. And someone else's opinion of how you're doing or what you're doing is none of your business. You know this, friends. I know you do. So why is it that your dreams are still hiding out in your heart instead of taking shape in your hands? It's not a fear of failure that keeps you in this place. It's a fear of what other people will think of your failure. O-P-O, other people's opinions. You down with it? Because if you are, you're giving all your power away. The opinion of the other moms at school, the opinion of the Hulks in my boxing gym, the opinion of strangers on the internet or my parents or even my fans, the second I start to give inordinate weight to any of it is the second my priorities get out of alignment. When other people's expectations start to dictate your actions, you're lost. Your hope, your dreams, your sense of self, it all gets lost. You want to make real strides for yourself and your goals this year? Stop caring about what they think of you. Stop giving power to someone else's opinions. Inevitably, when I say something like this, the question that comes back is about accountability and whether we can truly maintain our integrity if we have no sounding board. First of all, you know what's right and wrong. You know what's true. Down in your gut, you know how the best version of yourself would live out this day, this life you've been given. You may not always get to that place, but you know what it is you're striving for. So don't underestimate that. Secondly, if you're truly blessed, you will have people in your life who are confidants and true friends. Their wisdom will be your counsel, and you can seek them out when you need to. But, and here's the place where people get tripped up. There is a big difference between wanting someone's opinion and needing their approval. The latter typically comes disguised as the former. We ask for an opinion because we're feeling unsure about something, and often if we can find someone to agree, we somehow justify the idea as good or bad. Yesterday, I made this mistake with my husband. He is my best friend and counselor, and I still had to separate his opinion from what I really wanted. I have this idea for a new book, a new fiction book.